Blog Talk Radio.
From Fairfax, Virginia, where it's a somewhat overcast and cool day. And this is Military Monday, and I am your host, John Gresham. Over the past couple of weeks, and really through much of the month of November, there has been a slowly developing but very serious crisis emerging out in the East China Sea. It involves something called an Air Defense Identification Zone, or ADIZ, which is one of the means that countries around the world use to control airspace that is in their territorial areas of control. This one involves two such areas, one which has been in existence for a while, run by the island nation of Japan. The other one, which has recently been expanded, is that run by the People's Republic of China. And the problem here is that the Chinese recently added a great deal of territory in the East China Sea area, and now theirs now overlaps the Japanese, and we have the beginnings of a serious crisis over who controls air travel and air flight in those regions. And at the same time, there is an ongoing territorial dispute between the Chinese and a number of their neighbors over something they call exclusive economic zones or resource zones out in the waterways and oceans off their coasts. We are going to go and talk about this crisis and the whole situation with China and their expanding interest in resource gathering today. And to go and talk to us about it, we've brought in an old friend of ours, Christopher David Young from the National Defense University. Chris has previously been with us talking about his book from U.S. Naval Institute called The Gators of Neptune about the amphibious equipment and operations that were used in the D-Day invasion. And at the same time, this particular area of China, its military, its politics, and its policies just happens to be what he does for a real-world living at the National Defense University at Fort McNair in Washington, D.C. Chris, are you there, sir?
I am, John. Thank you for the invite today. It's my pleasure to be here.
Oh, listen, we're thrilled to have you because there just aren't that many people who can talk about this. And let's make it very clear. You know, Syria is a nasty little war, and the Iranians are trying to go nuclear, and, you know, there's all kinds of things going on around the world that are unpleasant. But this is serious. This is currently involving you know, multiple nuclear powers and some of the largest countries, population and size-wise, on the planet, is it not?
That's correct. It is a very serious issue. I'm glad you're bringing it to your attention in your radio show.
Well, we appreciate having you. And let's start by saying, okay, why? And I'm gonna do this first segment to try and explain why the various nations in this region don't get along well, because we tend to go and have the habit here in the United States of when we have a war with someone, we like to help them rebuild and make friends out of them, even allies. You know, we fought two wars with Great Britain in just 40 years, including our revolution. Today, at least in theory, they're one of our closest allies. Same with Germany. Two major wars in the first half of the 20th century. One of our best friends out there. So, but here we have China and its neighbors. Why can't they just get along? And let's make it clear, this is an old, old grudge that begins back in the days of a gentleman by the name of Kublai Khan, if I'm not mistaken. Please explain. Bring it
all
forward
right,
for.
Well, let's go back a few millennia. Let's go back a couple of hundreds, perhaps even a thousand years. So if you look at the Asia-Pacific region, China has traditionally seen itself as the dominant culture, the dominant political system, the dominant political entity of the region. China, the word for China in Chinese, Zhongguo, essentially means central kingdom, the center of it all, center of the universe. So China has traditionally seen itself as the center of the region, what it then saw itself as the universe. The other countries in the region have essentially been vassal states, subordinate countries, subordinate political entities to China's vast superiority. So Japan, Korea, the Southeast Asian countries are always seen as countries that have been subordinate to China. And so China has for a thousand years or so seen itself as the dominant regional hegemonic power, and the other countries were expected to behave that way. That came to an end by the middle of the 19th century. China was in a state of decay, the Qing dynasty, its last dynasty, was in a state of decay, and China was confronted with the West. And so China then had to recognize that it no longer was in a position of superiority over the other countries. In the meantime, Japan, right around that time frame, went through the Meiji Restoration, where it reformed itself and essentially became a modern nation-state with a modern military capability. So from the late 19th century till about the Second World War, Japan was ascendant, taking over bits and pieces of Chinese territory and essentially engaged in the Second World War. So this, you're right, there is a long-standing grudge match between China and Japan. China seeing itself as the rightful dominant power in the region, Japan seeing itself as an emerging modern power, and essentially seeing China as a nation in decay. The two countries have essentially been, and obviously the results of the Second World War with some of the atrocities Japan undertook has left a lot of hard feelings in the region. So China isn't the only one with hard feelings. South Korea also feels Japan misbehaved during the Second World War. And so therefore this is a long-standing grudge match between China and Japan, and Japan and some of the other countries in the region, and frankly, it's very difficult for them to resolve these issues through rational negotiation.
And just as an example of how deep and how far back this gripe goes, is it not true that the word kamikaze or divine wind refers to a great storm that destroyed the fleet of the great Chinese emperor Kublai Khan hundreds of years ago, and then and saved the Japanese dynasty of the time.
Yeah, so there is a long-standing military history between the two. That's correct. The divine wind does go back that far. It's noted that the Japanese tended historically to be a divided people, except when threatened by a common foe, and China tended to be that common foe. And the Kublai Khan incident is a perfect example of how the Japanese were able to unify to deal with the Chinese invasion.
And as you point out, the Koreas don't get along with Japan that well, although obviously North Korea is a great ally of the People's Republic. Similarly, Taiwan, looked upon as a rogue province by the People's Republic, has its own problems with Japan and the mainland. Then, of course, you add Vietnam, other nations in Southeast Asia, Indonesia, Malaysia. This is not a happy region in a lot of ways.
No. Well, and we can talk a little bit later about the positive aspects of this, which is economics. Some have argued that there are two Asias. One is the economic side, which is thriving, which is an engine of growth globally. And then there are these military and political rivalries that go back centuries, if not millennia, that have made it very difficult for these countries to see past some of these tensions to come to some agreements on economically with one another, even though everybody knows that it's to everyone's benefit to set aside some of these feuds and arrive at good economic deals that can be had between these countries.
And let us make it very clear that everybody involved in this, ourselves, the Chinese, the Japanese, and the other is various what are called little dragons, all understand crisis is bad for business.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, no, no. There's no question that they all recognize that crisis, conflict, military buildup, shooting war, any type of military tension is bad for business. And no one wants to think of the consequences if a shooting war does happen. They all recognize it, though. And we certainly, in discussions with all of these countries, point that out. Many optimists believe that will serve as a firewall to any sort of open military conflict between these countries. That is, the idea that economics, business, growth for all these countries cannot be sustained if we're in the middle of some sort of shooting match between these countries. But yes, they all recognize that military conflict is bad for business. Military tensions are bad for business. Some of these long-standing feuds and rivalries continue to simmer, and there are national sentiments within a lot of these countries which prevent the governments from making some of the compromises that they need to make in order to cut deals with the other countries.
And with that, let us go and talk about the points of view and the standing of the various nations involved in this little confrontation. Let's start with the People's Republic of China. Obviously, the People's Republic is the largest economy in the region. They are the United States' biggest debtor nation in terms of they finance us, and they are also one of our largest trading partners. What is their point of view towards the world, the region, and this particular situation? Take a few minutes and talk to us about it.
Okay, that could take up an entire radio segment, which I know we don't have, but let me give them
my
best
shot. Give us the Reader's Digest version, sir.
All right, okay, the Reader's Digest version. I mean, clearly China, since the late 1970s to the latter part of the 20th century, saw as its number one objective to build itself up, to develop itself economically, and therefore years of communist rule from 1949 till about 1978-79, the Chinese reversed its ultra-communist policies that had been pursued by Mao Zedong and took on a strategy of reform and economic development under Deng Xiaoping. What we have seen, what the statistics or the characterization you just gave us, is a result of the last 30 years of relentless reform and economic development. So the Chinese have pursued a strategy of economic development, opening to the world, better relations with the United States and the countries in the region for the purposes of developing itself economically, raising the living standards of its people. The complication is the Chinese also pursue a policy of retaining the Chinese Communist Party in rule. Therefore, you still have an authoritarian government who is absolutely intent on maintaining itself in power. Therefore, a lot of these territorial disputes that you see now, the Chinese Communist Party absolutely has to take a hard line on these territorial disputes because, for nationalist reasons, it's the only thing that essentially is holding the country together. The Chinese ideology, communist ideology, is gone. So essentially, the Chinese Communist Party is essentially holding the country together by nationalism, nationalist sentiments, the glory of China. Therefore, there is a demand by China's citizens to assert China's sovereignty over these different territorial disputes. So that's the Chinese outlook. Now, underlying all that is also a view of strategic competition with the United States. That China recognizes itself as a rising power that's due to overtake the United States economically within a few years. China also sees itself as trying to get itself back to its rightful place as a dominant hegemonic power in the Asia-Pacific. That's China's outlook, and that's essentially where China's going into this today.
Okay, and to support these nationalistic goals, we've seen a great change in the Chinese military from simply being a lot of bodies armed with Kalashnikovs and RPGs they're now moving towards a modern 21st century military with more of the kinds of tools and weapons that can project real power outside of their own borders, correct?
That's absolutely right. What you've seen since China's economic development and reform has taken off, and China has been an economic success, China's military capabilities have increased to correspond to that economic development. And as usually happens, when your economic economy develops, your interests also expand. So China has interests beyond China, which the Chinese government realizes it now must protect. So let's just talk. I'll quickly describe some of the developments over the last 10 to 15 years. So China, whereas 20 years ago, 30 years ago, China had almost zero power projection capability. Most of its power and its military capability resided in its ground forces. It had the largest ground army in the world, and that had been the case for years. But what you have seen for the last 15 years is the development of its air and naval capabilities to project power further from China's immediate shores. Therefore, what do you see? You see the development, recent development and announcement of China's aircraft carrier, the Liaoning. You see China's ability to conduct counter-piracy operations in the Gulf of Aden area. You see a relentless development of its surface combatants, modern destroyers, underway replenishment ships. It's also developed a landing platform dock, an LPD, with an amphibious capability. In terms of aircraft, 20 to 30 years ago, I would have described Chinese military aircraft as a MiG-15, MiG-17, MiG-19 variants. You now have online Chinese aircraft that are the rough equivalents of F-15, F-16 capable aircraft. So the Chinese have arrived at third generation and on the verge of fourth generation aircraft, which are comparable to Western aircraft. So that's an extraordinary development of its military in just a very short period of time. Now, if we were to sit down and do a comparison with the United States military, I would certainly point to certain gaps in the Chinese capabilities. Lack of training, the fact that they haven't fought a war since 1979, a weakness in their NCO force, the fact that their training, and then of course there's also the problem of corruption in the Chinese military. But nonetheless, despite those weaknesses, China is on a very strong path to developing a strong military capability that, frankly, the United States is keeping a very close eye on. And I, as a member of the Department of Defense, we watch and we carefully watch the developments. But nonetheless, there are certain weaknesses that we note about China's military capabilities. But we also take note of the fact that China is on a very strong path to modern military.
In other words, they're enhancing both capacity and capability, and going places that, if you want to be a great power, that they're doing the right, they're buying the right stuff, they're doing the right things.
That's correct. I mean, it is clear that they are buying the right stuff and doing the right things, and they also learn. In every interaction we have with the Chinese, they're constantly trying to understand how we do business, how we train our forces, how we train our personnel. They're very interested in understanding joint operations. They're very interested in understanding a whole host of things on how we do business. Now, obviously, the United States has to be careful on what we show to a potential strategic competitor, and we take very close note of that. But at the same time, because of the ambiguous situation the United States is in with China, we are not in a Cold War with China. We are not in a shooting war with China. We are two countries that are interlinked, that are linked economically, and at present, the current U.S. policy is to develop a good working relationship with a country that can actually do some good if it actually puts the effort to it. So the United States does pay attention to China's growing military capability, but we must also work with this country as well to try and deal with some of the global problems the two countries are going to be facing in the 21st century.
And, of course, a growing economy means they have to have resources to go and feed that economy, to feed those factories, to build the housing and the roads and the other infrastructure. This means they're out going across the globe to go and harvest resources, interests in mining, gas and oil development, and other things. And this also includes the development of what are called exclusive economic zones. Talk a little bit about what those are and why they're important to the discussion we're having today.
Okay, well, let me just make a correction. Exclusive economic zones aren't something the Chinese alone developed. EEZs came about through the United Nations Convention on Law of the Sea in 1982. So the idea of an exclusive economic zone is decades old. Where the conflict comes from, or where the tensions arise, are in the interpretation of what an EEZ implies. So, therefore, the United States recognizes the EEZs for different countries. Many countries assert that they have exclusive economic zones. Where we all seem to differ is our interpretation of what an EEZ implies. So, for example, the United States recognizes that an EEZ for a country can extend out 200 nautical miles from a country's coastline. However, the United States feels that within an EEZ that still remains international waters. Therefore, we are free to transit through an EEZ. We are free to conduct military exercises, and most importantly, we can conduct monitoring, research, and other matters that are important to a military. Therefore, one of the biggest conflicts between the United States and China right now is the belief that the United States has that it can monitor within China's EEZ activities going on near China. The Chinese believe that their EEZ, their declaration of an EEZ, prevents us from doing such activities without China's permission. This relates to the discussion we're about to have on an air defense identification zone. But with regard to the EEZs themselves, we believe that we can monitor, conduct military exercises, can transit through, and can do almost any type of activity we would like within international waters and within China's EEZ extending out to 200 nautical miles. The Chinese do not believe that's the case. They believe that if we're going to conduct some sort of military activity, we have to notify them and we have to get their permission. That has led to some incidents that people may be familiar with over the last few years. For example, the EP3 spy plane, the EP3 incident in which we flew an EP3 out monitoring the coast of China, and they flew out an F-8, and they had a collision that led to a diplomatic crisis. That was in 2001. The Chinese have come out and tried to shoulder some of our electronic surveillance ships operating within China's EEZs, but in international waters. They have sent out maritime surveillance ships to try and harass, impede, and prevent our activities. This is very they've protested. We've indicated that principally we are permitted to do that. And you might note that our military leaders have gone and said to the Chinese, if you have a desire to operate Chinese military aircraft or ships within our EEZ, feel free to do so, because principally you have a right to do so. And we've actually made that statement. And the Chinese took us up on that by sending a PLA Navy task force in the area of Guam to monitor. And our response was, that's perfectly fine. We have no issues with that. So that's where the EEZs play into this whole story.
All right, and for our listeners, if you want to talk to us, please feel free to give us a call. Our call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. Again, our call-in number is area code 347-945-7246. And Chris, let's move on to our next segment, where let's talk about what has happened between China and its neighbors in the past few months, particularly in November of the month past. Specifically, what is an ADIZ, what are territorial waters, and how does this relate to the whole exclusive economic zone as China interprets it and the rest of the region and ourselves interpret it?
Okay, an air fence identification zone is not unique or new to China. This South Korea, Japan, the United States all have them. We've established them. What an ADIZ is, it's airspace specified by the country in which an unidentified aircraft or an identified aircraft enters into it, and we have declared that we have a right to monitor that airspace, monitor the specific aircraft coming in, and to determine the intentions of that aircraft and to determine whether that aircraft is a threat to the airspace of the country involved. So the United States, South Korea, Japan, all have had them. China has, what's recent is that China suddenly declared in November that it's now got an ADIZ. Now, why? The Chinese have argued that why is the Asia-Pacific, the countries of the Asia-Pacific region, particularly Japan and the United States, making such a fuss of this since the United States and Japan and South Korea have all had them for a while? Why is it that suddenly China cannot establish an ADIZ of its own? And the answer to that would be, and what I would say to my Chinese friends if I was having a debate over this would be, it's the fact that that this announcement came at a time when there is a territorial dispute between China and Japan, a heated one, and we can talk a little bit about how this has heated up over the last year or so. But at present, there's a rather hot and contested territorial dispute between China and Japan over the islands in the East China Sea. The Chinese call them the Diaoyu Islands. The Japanese call them the Senkaku Islands. Right in the middle of tensions between these two countries over these islets, China suddenly just declared that it has an ADIZ. And so what's particularly bad about this is the fact that right in the middle of this territorial dispute, the Chinese declared that they have an ADIZ. Secondly, whereas in the past, the countries who have established ADIZs have notified the other countries that this might have an effect on. China suddenly announced that here is an ADIZ without notifying or consulting with Japan, without notifying or consulting with the United States. It went and established an ADIZ. Third, because of the fact that there is a territorial dispute, China can utilize an ADIZ as a means to ratchet up the pressure on Japan. That is, as a means to exert increased political pressure on the Japanese. It also gives a pretext for the Chinese to flow aircraft and to harass Japanese aircraft. And then having some sort of legal pretext. Well, we indicated that we were going to establish an ADIZ, and the fact that we then intercepted your aircraft should not be a surprise to Japan because China declared in November that it would do so. So this gives China a pretext to exert pressure on Japan, and it gives them a legal cover to then act in a belligerent manner and then have the legal means to hide behind that act. So this is why this is particularly worrying to the United States and why the United States and Japan reacted very strongly to the establishment of an ADIZ this past month.
Let's talk a little bit about why the other problem with this, and that is it overlaps the existing Japanese ADIZ, and it has a footprint over an existing gas and oil field in the East China Sea. Talk about this ADIZ and the real estate it sits on top of and intrudes upon with Japan.
Well, as I said before, Japan did have an ADIZ, and it's had one for the last 44 years. The overlap would mean that what's possible is that any aircraft that flies into this overlap between China's ADIZ and Japan's ADIZ has the potential in which PLA Air Force aircraft and Japan Air Self-Defense Force aircraft then move to intercept one another, will be flying in the vicinity of one another and acting in ways that may be hostile to one another. This could lead to an accidental collision, could lead to an accidental shootdown of one of the other aircraft, so tensions could escalate and things could get worse. Now, with regard to the gas field, yes, this is disputed territory between Japan and China. Both have claimed the resources underneath, which there's potential gas in the Chunxiao gas field, as the Chinese call it. Now, what's interesting, and we can have this discussion a little bit later on, is the potential for economic cooperation. The Chinese and the Japanese actually had been in discussion over joint exploitation of the gas field, but they have not been able to finalize and actually come to an agreement that's satisfactory to both countries. But you're right, resources certainly play in this. The Japanese certainly see the resources in the area as vital to their economy. The Chinese see gas resources as important to them. And so, yes, resources play a role. But I think even more important is the fact that both countries see sovereignty, the rightful limitation of territory that belongs to that country, as central to their identity and their own their political legitimacy. So I would find it very difficult for the Chinese to back down for purposes of national sovereignty. And similarly, Prime Minister Abe, I do not see backing down because he, for one thing, sees national sovereignty as an important issue as well. So, yes, the economic resources are important, certainly is a major factor in the thinking, the calculus of the two countries. But sovereignty, I think, even outweighs that even more so.
And as a, shall we say, trained and experienced observer, could the Chinese have plopped this zone into any more delicate place in terms of geography? I mean, it's south of the Korean Peninsula. It's southwest of Honshu. It's northeast of Taiwan and due north of the Philippines. I mean, you couldn't have put a bigger bullseye out in the middle of the water, could you?
Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, again, like I said, the fact that this was announced in the time of territorial tensions and disputes between these countries, the fact that they were right now in the middle of tense times, and as you pointed out, that's pretty interesting real estate that the Chinese have put this thing down on. The Taiwan aspect of this is another wrinkle, which I think is very interesting, and it's curious why Taiwan has remained relatively quiet on this issue. But nonetheless, but I do think, however, that this is clearly directed at Japan. Japan is clearly the target of this ADIZ. Although Korea is also, the Koreans have also noted that they're affected by this as well.
And in terms of their ability to resist this, the Japanese and the Koreans are not paper tigers. They have very good, very well-equipped, very modern, and in their cases, fairly well-trained and experienced military forces, do they not?
They do. That's true. However, I would note the following things. The tit-for-tat and the pressure being placed on both countries by each other resides for now not in the military realm but in the paramilitary realm. So the Chinese are using civilian law enforcement vessels, their China Maritime Surveillance Force, to make incursions into Japanese EEZs. Japan has responded with Japanese Coast Guard. And it's a back and forth, putting pressure on one another to remain persistent in the air. Essentially, the way I perceive this is China is trying to wear Japan down and trying to call into question Japan's administrative control over the Senkaku Islands. If you call into question Japan's administrative control over the Senkaku Islands, Japan perhaps may acquiesce and declare, yes, there's truly a dispute we need to settle and negotiate with the Chinese. The other thing this does is the fact that the United States' Mutual Defense Treaty, Article 5, calls for the United States to support Japan, Japan's administrative control over the islands. If it's in question whether or not Japan actually has administrative control over the islands, the Chinese may be reasoning that the United States' support for Japan will also weaken. And so that's what the Chinese are trying to do. From my perspective, they're trying to weaken Japan's hold and their control over those islands. They're trying to weaken the United States' support for Japan through its mutual defense treaty, and it's trying to weaken Japan's resolve to get Japan to the negotiating table and to admit that there's a dispute between the two countries and to get Japan to negotiate on terms favorable to China. We see similar activity and actions taking place in the South China Sea, but right now our focus is on the East China Sea. But you can make an argument that the last year's dispute over the Scarborough Shoal with the Philippines was a similar activity that the Chinese undertook to weaken the Philippines' resolve in controlling and maintain and managing its holdings in the southern part of the South China Sea, and questioning the United States' ability to support the Philippines. So I think what we're seeing is a pattern of China putting pressure on these countries to relent, to give in, and then essentially leaving China in a more favorable, advantageous position after this is all through.
All right, and with that, we're going to take a quick break and run a couple of network messages, and when we come back, we're going to talk to Christopher David Young about what has happened thus far and what might happen with this. This is the RightStream Radio Network.
Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network, tune in to host Daria Ann for RightStream Tuesday. Daria Ann interviews talented authors in a variety of literary genres, from urban fantasy and historical romance to autobiography and science fiction. RightStream Tuesday celebrates the creativity that flows through every author. It also delves into the all-important publishing and marketing aspects of writing, including the benefits and pitfalls of independent publishing versus traditional publishing, and how to effectively use social media for success. RightStream Tuesday with Daria Ann. Tuesday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network.
Hi, this is Lisa Tarvis. I'm a metaphysician, board-certified holistic health practitioner, energy healer, intuitive, and the author of the book, Just Believe. I'm also a host on the RightStream Network. My radio show is called Just Believe and airs every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern. Please stop by my website at www.lisatarvis.com. That's LISATARVES. For details on all the services I offer, information on my book, and my radio show. There are many amazing guests and fascinating topics scheduled for the show in the upcoming months. I look forward to connecting with you soon.
Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network. Tune in to Military Monday with host John D. Gresham, author, military historian, and journalist. John delves into a unique aspect of U.S. military history, as well as current events and issues affecting our men and women in uniform. Featuring exceptional guests, military experts, and authors, Military Monday with John D. Gresham entertains, informs, and encourages listeners to support those who put it all on the line for freedom. Military Monday with John D. Gresham, Monday afternoons at 1 o'clock Eastern on the RightStream Radio Network.
And we're back. Are you there with us, Chris?
I sure am, John.
Okay. Well, we've talked a lot about the gripes and the capabilities and the economics. Let's talk a little bit about what can possibly go wrong. And as you and I know, anytime you get modern military forces in close proximity, literally eyeball to eyeball, you're on a ship, you're looking a couple of thousand yards off to the side, there's a ship from someone else. Maybe you're cool with it. Maybe you're all locked and loaded and keeping a close eye. But there's the possibility of bad things happening here, isn't there?
Absolutely.
When we say bad, what do we mean by bad? Let's run down some of the possible quote-unquote accidents or some of the things that can happen when modern military forces start shoving each other or shouldering.
Well, let's start off for a second with things that we've already seen happen that could be repeated in the East China Sea. So I alluded to, I mentioned earlier about the EP-3 collision with an F-8 that happened in 2001. That could happen again. And that led to a diplomatic and political crisis between the two countries for a number of weeks. In that instance, an EP3 was monitoring China's coasts, and two Chinese F-8s came out to intercept. The Chinese F-8 actually got quite close and ultimately collided with the P-3, who ultimately had to conduct an emergency landing on Hainan Island. So you can have direct collisions between military forces happen. Same thing can happen at sea. We had a couple of incidents where U.S. monitoring ships were harassed and actually came quite close to colliding with China maritime surveillance ships. In these types of instances, U.S. Navy has called for discussions with the Chinese to discuss rules of the road, proper behavior at sea. We right now have an annual meeting with the Chinese Navy, the U.S. Navy and the Chinese Navy in Hawaii and in Beijing. They alternate per year, called the Military Maritime Consultative Agreements, MMCA, in which we discuss proper rules of the road and how we interact with one another when we're in close proximity with one another. But the fact of the matter is internationally we have plenty of agreements, norms, to essentially guide the way we should behave with one another in close proximity. What we have seen, however, is the Chinese either ignoring these different norms and regulations for political purposes. That is, they want to send a signal to the United States that they're displeased over some matter. They're displeased with how close we are getting to their coasts, and so they're using they're essentially playing cat and mouse with their military and our military to send political signals. This is quite dangerous and could lead to quite some hairy incidents. There's been some research on the similarity between this type of activity and the type of activity the Russians in the United States undertook during the Cold War. Now, the difference, however, was that there were many, many more such encounters between the Soviet Union and the United States. So we haven't reached that level of intensity and that level of cat and mouse playing between the two militaries. Nonetheless, it's significant enough that it's got the attention of the military leadership in the United States and the military leadership in China. And you're absolutely right.
It's worth noting that, you know, back during the bad old days of the Cold War, yes, we used to play cowboys and Russians with the Soviets and, you know, bumping, shoving between submarines, underwater, surface ships and such. We'd have a couple of those every year. But we also had a protocol called the Incidents at Sea Agreement that allowed us to go and resolve them, assign responsibility, and hopefully work out procedures to not do it again. Do we have similar kinds of arrangements with the Chinese, or is that something that is a little beyond our current relationship?
Well, as I mentioned before, we have a yearly discussion, which, from the U.S. perspective, our experience during the Cold War pushes us towards trying to come up with some sort of INC-C agreement with the Chinese. So our model as we go in, I've talked to the Pacific Fleet staff who actually engage in those negotiations, and their view is that they go into those discussions hoping to arrive at common rules of the road that they can have an understanding with the Chinese over this. However, they have repeatedly indicated to me over the last few years, this may have changed this past year or so, but in the years past, they have said that the Chinese tend to use those discussions as a means to politically beat up on the United States, that is to make shouts, to essentially indicate that we have differences of opinion and that they don't really roll their sleeves up and get down to the business of talking about rules of the road, and they really fixate on the differences between the two countries and the differences in our interests. So right now, no, there is no INC-C agreement. The United States would like to arrive at those common rules of the road. The Chinese recently who I've talked to say, yes, there actually is progress going on in the development of those rules of the road, but I would have to re-engage with the PAC fleet staff to get their view on that. The Chinese have said that, yes, there's progress being made and that they're working towards it. I have not yet spoken with the PAC fleet guys to verify that is the case.
In the case of the Japanese and the Koreans and such, how likely is the possibility that they're going to get into some shoving matches in the air in the overlapping ADIZs? And is there the possibility that someone might get angry and unload a Sidewinder or an AMRAAM or, you know, bump wings? I mean, what would be the kinds of situations which would cause that kind of anger and flare-up in the skies over the East China Sea?
Well, I think between the two countries, the more likely candidate to have a shoving match between the Chinese with the Chinese would be the Japanese. I think the Koreans, while concerned with the Chinese declaration of an ADIZ, are probably a little bit more circumspect, a little bit more cautious about directly engaging with the Chinese. The Japanese, however, on the other hand, I think there's a great likelihood that could happen. And the scenario in which that plays out. Hello?
I'm here.
Okay, I'm sorry. The scenario in which that could happen, we almost have an example of that happening just recently. The Japanese Air Self-Defense Force had indicated that as they overflew and were monitoring the PLA Navy, one of the Chinese ships actually turned on and locked on. Turned on its fire control system, fire control radar, which is a very, very dangerous thing to do, very escalatory.
It's a very hostile act in naval circles.
In the naval circles, that's very, very hostile. When I went to China and actually had a discussion with the Chinese over this issue, they denied that that actually happened. They said that didn't happen. You're being misled by the Japanese. Of course, when I talked to our Japanese allies about this, they said no, that definitely happened, and that incident was confirmed by Admiral Locklear, our Pacific commander. The Chinese view on this also is that the Japanese have been the ones who've been acting aggressively, that their aircraft have flown in between their formations, and that they have been very aggressive in their dealings with the Chinese. The Japanese, of course, denied that is the case.
Hello.
Yes, I'm still on.
Okay. Hello?
Hello?
Are you still with me?
Yes, I am.
Okay, hang on a second. Okay, that should take care of it. Are you still with me?
Yes, I am, John. Sorry for
Okay, good. Sorry, a little technical problem here, but go ahead. Please, continue on with what you were saying about Admiral Locklear.
Yeah, Admiral Locklear had confirmed that the incident that the Chinese denied that they had turned on their fire control radar indeed actually happened. So he confirmed it. The Japanese had said, yes, of course this happened. The Chinese denied that it happened. And the Chinese also turned around and it indicated that the Japanese had been acting aggressively in their aircraft monitoring of their vessels and in their vessels. And so we're having a he said, she said moment. But from what I've heard from the Pacific Command staff and from the Pacific Fleet staff is that, yes, indeed, we can confirm that the Chinese action was rather hostile, and we've noted that to the Chinese.
Has this reached the point where either the Japanese or the Chinese or the Koreans moved regular Navy units into the region, or is it still pretty much limited to, as you say, paramilitary and Coast Guard type units thus far?
As far as I know, it's right now it remains to be a paramilitary Coast Guard show with the militaries in the background perhaps waiting to get involved. Now, the Japan Air Self-Defense Force has flown out, scrambled to meet with Chinese air incursions, and so to some degree, Japan's military has been involved. From the Chinese side, they've pretty much stuck to their paramilitary forces being the spearhead with their military in the background. And my discussions with the Chinese have also indicated that this is a deliberate strategy of the Chinese. They want to put pressure on Japan without necessarily having military-to-military confrontation. They want to ratchet up the pressure while holding on to while controlling escalation. If they need to, they can put in a PLA Navy ship to ratchet up the escalation even further. But right now, the Chinese have held it at the paramilitary level.
And it's worth noting that this expanded ADIZ of the Chinese, as well as the Japanese one, overlap over one of the busiest air corridors in the world coming down on the Great Circle route from Alaska to East Asia. Talk a little bit about how commercial airlines and private aircraft are being affected by this, shall we say, collective misunderstanding, and what has been the responses within the airline industry and the governments involved?
Well, right now, the establishment of the Chinese establishment of an ADIZ requires that commercial airlines file a flight plan with the Chinese government. So that's a complication already that we've seen already. The responses have been varied depending on by country. South Korea and Japan have refused to comply with that requirement. The United States has notified its commercial airlines to go ahead and comply with the Chinese request for the simple sake of safety. Now, what's interesting from all this is that in every negotiation or discussion I've had with the Chinese, and that various individuals who meet with the Chinese over these types of issues, the Chinese have long said, the United States always argues that freedom of navigation is your core interest. Well, nothing that we are doing in terms of establishing or asserting our maritime territorial rights has any effect on navigation. Well, I think right here is proof positive that there is an effect on navigation. And so what I find interesting is the Chinese are acting in this way, and this is now, in my opinion, added another bit of ammunition for an argument we can make that this does indeed imperil navigation, and certainly the United States won't take kindly to that.
And the result is that you have U.S. flag carriers going and filing flight plans with both the Japanese and the Chinese in this case, correct?
That's correct. That is the case. From what I've heard, that's the most recent recommendation by the U.S. government to its commercial carriers. Go ahead and file flight plans both with Japan and China.
At least that's what it was at the State Department briefing on Friday afternoon.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And perhaps I'm old enough to remember when we used to deal with this in a somewhat more positive, and I mean, not so much good as decisive manner, but if this was the day of Ronald Reagan and someone was playing this game with us, say Libya with their line of death over the Gulf of Sidra, would not our move would have been to go and move a carrier group into this area and conduct missile firing and air combat drills for 3 or 4 days just to show that we don't care?
Perhaps, but I would, and in fact, a good friend of mine was on one of those ships that did that type of fawn op. So yes, perhaps a different president might have acted a little bit more assertively. But I would point out one important thing though: Libya versus China. We're talking different orders of magnitude of scale. But how the administration decides to deal with this is going to be interesting to watch. I think the fact that we flew two B-52s through the area is to me a good sign. The fact that we didn't take this lightly.
Agreed, and of course there is no reason to believe that the George Washington, which has been finishing up operations in the Philippines and of course conducting some exercises as well, is certainly available to go ahead and drive through there if they want. But as you well point out, China's a little different from Libya and some of the other nations we've dealt with. For one thing, they are a nuclear power with a credible navy and air force. One does not necessarily want to just go and act in a high-handed or precipitous fashion with these people.
That's correct. That's correct. We do need to be careful on how we respond. But the administration, and I would say any administration, would have to walk a fine line between being, as you put it, high-handed, and at the same time not giving the impression that China's actions or activities are fully acceptable and something that the United States doesn't worry about. So the administration is walking a very fine line, and so far I'm seeing that they are walking that fine line. So we'll see how this plays out over the next few weeks, next few months.
And maybe the next few years. Let's talk about some of the long-range possibilities. We've discussed the short-term possibilities, but eventually people are going to go and take a breath, and this is going to become a version of normal, is it not?
This could be a version of normal, which some watchers of China have said that the Chinese activities could each time could lead to a new normal. Each time that new normal is a situation advantageous to China. The new normal, however, over a long period of time, could lead to some serious tensions between the countries in the region. In addition, there's an element of this that we haven't talked about too much yet. I mentioned it at the very beginning of the show. But there's also an underlying strategic competition between China and the United States that also has to be played into this. That is, the Chinese long-term view of its role in the Asia-Pacific may be to essentially achieve what it had lost. That is, it was the dominant power in the Asia-Pacific. It wants the United States ultimately out of the region once China has developed itself economically to such a point that China can assert itself to that degree. So if that's a long-term objective of China, and the long-term objective of the United States is essentially to remain present in the Asia-Pacific because it's a central piece of the United States' security policy and its economic policy, then we are in for a very difficult ride down the road over the next 20 or so years. If China is essentially trying to push us out and we are essentially trying to stay in, we could be in for a very long ride as we jostle against one another.
And as we pointed out, crisis is bad for business. I mean, yes, I realize the kanji character for crisis is also opportunity here, but let's face it. We face something of an intriguing what we used to call, where I grew up in Southern California, Mexican standoff, where, yes, China is one of our largest trading partners and our biggest debtor. In other words, we owe them money which supports our deficit and our government. But at the same time, they are one of their largest trading partners, and if we default, it does all kinds of damage to their finances, their workforce, and other things. I mean, we are two nations that are very much maybe in a bad marriage, but we need each other, do we not?
That's a very good way of putting it. The two countries may be indeed in a bad marriage, but absolutely need each other. And I think that's absolutely correct. I think that economics will ultimately trump a lot of the feuds, tensions, and even the strategic competition I just mentioned a second ago. That is, China may see itself as wanting to be the dominant power in the region and to ultimately shove the United States out of the region. But to do so, China needs a thriving, growing economy to do that. And to do that, it needs the United States. It needs the global international economic order that the United States has erected since the Second World War. So it's a very interesting conundrum both countries are in. China needs the United States and the international system it's built. It needs the United States' leadership to essentially maintain order and stability in the Asia-Pacific and globally so that China can continue to thrive. The United States needs the second largest economy in the world, as a partner to help resolve a lot of our public policy issues, global, transnational issues that we need to resolve. But on the flip side, for both countries, the United States sees China as a growing strategic competitor who asserts itself and acts belligerently in some ways and threatening the U.S. allies. China sees the United States as a strategic competitor who can get in the way of China achieving what it ultimately wants, to be the hegemonic power of the region again. So both countries have this dual-sided, two-coined problem with one another, problem and benefit in its relationship with the other.
Long term, do you see the Chinese wanting to go and get into resource development and sharing arrangements? And the example I like to use is the British-Norwegian development of the North Sea oil fields. Do you see them becoming a little less hegemonic and becoming a little more partner-oriented, or are they a mature enough nation to do that?
I think that that's entirely a possibility. The fact is China has engaged in some joint economic development deals with the countries of the region. They engaged in such a deal with Vietnam. They were about to embark on a joint economic deal with the Philippines and Vietnam before domestically the Philippines had to back out of the agreement. So China can engage in that type of joint economic deal if the factors are there politically and if the right deal can be struck. So I wouldn't rule out China's ability to do that. However, a lot of these sovereignty issues, nationalist issues, make it very difficult for the countries of this area to sign those types of agreements, to arrive at that type of deal. But I wouldn't rule them out, but I would say it would take a great deal of crafty diplomacy, a great deal of leadership in all the countries involved, and that is a tall order, in my opinion.
Realistically, long term, are we going to have a war, or is there going to be a major regional war in this part of the world, or do you believe the economic interactions between all the partners and the dragons out there is sufficient to go ahead and make what Dean Acheson's call cooler heads prevail?
You know, John, you've just asked me to lay out what is the major debate between all the China analysts, in, not only in this town but worldwide, whether or not there's going to be a conflict.
Give me a Ronald Reagan answer. At 22 seconds, 50 words or less. If you can do that, you're on your way to a peace prize, my friend.
my bottom line is, I think cooler heads will ultimately prevail because the money, the economy involved. The stakes are just too high to mess around with that. So I ultimately am an optimist and believe that there will not be some sort of major systemic conflict if the two sides conduct their foreign policy and defense policies correctly. And that means the United States has to maintain a good, strong military presence in the region with good, strong military capability to maintain deterrence with China. That, to me, means that will ensure the peace over the next 50 to 100 years.
And with that, I think we're going to stop this discussion, though don't go anywhere. We might want to have this talk again next month at the rate we're going. You never know. Chris, obviously I'm going to take a wild guess and say normally this is the part of the show where I say, well, what are you working on in your day job? And I get the funny feeling that what I just been talking to you about for the last hour is what you've been working on at your day job. But what are you doing, and what do you got planned for long term at this point?
Well, in terms of the day job, right now at National Defense University, we have frequent consultations with the Chinese military to talk about all of these different issues. We also have frequent consultations with our allies. I just got back from Seoul, having discussions with the Koreans and with the Japanese. Actually, we had a trilateral discussion. So part of my job is to actually talk with the countries of the region, the militaries of the region, to talk about all these security issues. Long-term research projects, I'm doing South China Sea disputes, where I've examined the different tactics the countries use to advance and protect their claims. That should be an interesting report, directly relevant to what we're working on. I'm also looking at Taiwan defense. I'm taking a good hard look at the ability of the island of Taiwan to protect itself, given China's growing military capabilities. I'm also looking, in related to questions you've raised earlier in the show, I'm also looking at China's out-of-area operations, its ability to project power and to conduct operations further and further away from the Asia-Pacific, in the Indian Ocean, on the continent of Africa, its ability to do non-combatant evacuation operations, humanitarian assistance, disaster relief, and our likelihood or ability to interact with the Chinese in that context.
Sounds like you got a busy winter ahead of you.
But anytime you want to talk about this, I'm happy to do it, John.
I'm going to keep you on speed dial, my friend, because this could get exciting over the holiday season, to say the least. Chris, I want to thank you for coming on the show again. Thank you for your candor and your insights. I think you've probably done as much to go and explain to our listeners what's going on and who the players are as any discussion I've heard in the media over the past month. I really appreciate your help and your time.
My pleasure, John. Anytime.
Talk to you again soon.
Okay, thank you. Talk to you soon.
And with that, we've come to the end of another edition of Military Monday. Over the next few weeks, we're going to be talking about a number of topics. We're hoping to finally get in a good show on sexual harassment and sexual assault in the military. We're also going to hopefully be talking a little bit about cutbacks in benefits and services for active duty military, especially the proposed closing of commissaries. But for now, I'm just going to say have a great week ahead. Be safe, stay warm, and we'll see you again next week on Military Monday.
I took a flat to a pawn shop for a broken guitar. I took a flat to a pawn shop. How much is that guitar? I took a flat to a pawn shop. I got me that guitar. What's a flat in a pawn shop to me? Saw a man on the TV in a mask with a gun. A man on the TV, he had a 10-year-old son. I saw a man on the TV, his son had a gun. Cry. I wrote a song for a dead man to settle my soul. A song for a dead man, and now I'll never grow old. I wrote a song for a dead man, and now I'm out in the cold. What's a song? Doorstep wailing away. There's a baby on the doorstep longing for the day. There's a baby on the doorstep who gives his life to take. A flag to a pawn shop. A flag to a pawn shop. May he forget why he is crying so dead.